This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Some of us imagine a wonderful past when family life was defined by a glorious compound where three generations lived and helped each other. Others thank God every day that our parents are indeed a phone call away and not in the room next door. Family, they define us, they love us, they drive us crazy. But how much do we incorporate our extended family in our daily lives? How much do we want to? And how has that changed over time? Later on in the hour, we'll talk about the compulsion of so many families to gather annually for reunions from 15 to 500, a look at how reunions shape family life, and some practical tips to give a good one. But first, extended families. Why do we need them? When do we need them? And is our need that different from our ancestors? Take a look at your own family history. How has the interdependence on extended families changed? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from his home in Minneapolis is Stephen Ruggles. He is a history professor at the University of Minnesota and the director of the Minnesota Population Center. Welcome to the show, Professor Ruggles.
Thank you.
Let's start with definitions. What do we mean by the extended family?
Well, I guess that most people mean any kind of relatives other than mom, dad, and the kids, and that could include elderly parents, adult siblings, nephews, nieces, aunts, uncles, and so on.
Anything beyond the immediate nuclear family, then?
Yeah.
Has that definition changed at all over time?
Well, I think that some people use it to mean the co-residential group, the group that actually lives together, and other people use it to mean the kin group, regardless of whether they're living together or not. But I don't think there's a systematic change in the term, but I think there's a huge amount of change in the family itself.
Yeah. How has Americans' dependence on their extended families changed over the years?
Well, you know, for about the last half century, sociologists have been stressing how the extended family relationships are continuing to be extraordinarily important. And I think they're right. For many people, extended family relationships play a vital role in their lives. But I also think that there's a huge amount of evidence that the strength of extended kin ties has declined dramatically over time. I think one of the best pieces of evidence we have for this is the living arrangements of elderly people. In 1850, three-quarters of people over the age of 65 lived with their grown children. And that declined steadily to a low point of about 15% in 1990. And that's just a huge transformation. Since 1990, there's been a little bit of a pickup in that. Some people argue that if you just look at living together, that doesn't really tell you what's going on, because people can have very important close ties even if they don't live together. And I do think that living together is critical, and it makes more difference to your life if you see somebody every morning at breakfast than if you call them three times a week. But we also have evidence on kin ties outside of the household, and that only goes back about 40 years. But it also shows the same trend. For example, in 1962, about half the elderly reported that they saw their adult children at least once a day, and now that's only about a quarter. And we've got similar evidence for telephone contact, financial assistance, other measures of interaction between parents and their grown children.
Well, the myth, and it may be a reality, is that when extended families were strong, they raised children collectively, they helped care for the elderly. Is that true or false?
Well, I think more often than not, the elderly were helping care for the kids. I mean, I think that throughout as far back as we can measure, which is the middle of the 19th century, it looks like the dependent generation was more often the younger generation than the older generation.
But now is it the older generation is the more dependent generation?
No, the current evidence shows that the transfers of wealth and assistance and of all types are much more likely to go from the elderly to their adult children than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the forces that have shaped the way we relate to our extended families now in a different kind of way?
Well, I think that the big factor, as far as I'm concerned, is the transformation in the American economy. You got to keep in mind that 200 years ago, the family was the unit of economic production. 85% of the population was engaged in agriculture in 1800, and that's only about 2% today. And the people who weren't in agriculture back then were also pretty much self-employed. They were shopkeepers, craftsmen, blacksmiths, carpenters, tavern keepers, so on and so forth. And so what's happened is we've had this extraordinary growth as a result of industrialization and economic development of wage labor jobs in manufacturing, services, and so on. And that really has undermined the economic logic of the extended family. Under the old system, the best economic opportunity the younger generation had was to stick around and inherit the farm or the family business. And with the growth of job opportunities, a lot of young men left the farm. They were looking for the high wages and excitement offered by town life. And that meant that fewer and fewer parents could also offer the incentive of agricultural inheritance or leaving them the business. And without the labor demands of the farm or the business, the older generation really didn't have any incentive to want to keep the kids around anyway, because they didn't need the labor. So I think that transformation is the most important. Of course, there's cultural changes, but I suspect those kind of follow the changes in the structure of the economy.
We're talking about families, especially particularly extended families today on Talk of the Nation. The number, if you'd like to join the discussion, 800-989-TALK. Let's go to Angela in, I believe it's in Oregon. Hi, Angela.
Yeah, Paloma. Hi. I heard your discussion, and it just brought to mind the own dynamic between me and my parents. It's that I somehow, somewhere along the way, developed a streak of independence, and they're having a really tough time to grapple with it. I'm 27, and, you know, they always say, well, come, let's help you. Let's, you know, help you remodel your house. Let's do this, let's do that. And I accept their help to some degree, but I have a really, really tough time with it. And their argument is like, no, that's our job as parents. We're supposed to be here for you, help you unclog your toilets, help you, you know, gravel your driveway. And I'm like, no, that's my job.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes too much family is not such a good thing.
Yeah, to them, I'm really getting the sense that that's just the way they're raised, and that's the way that they see the families to be. And somewhere, I guess, in maybe my own cynical generation, it's got to be more individualistic. My husband, to some degree, is the same way. Maybe we're just both independent, but I'm definitely getting a generational gap here.
Right. Thanks for that call. And let me ask Professor Ruggles, you know, that's sort of a classic kind of conflict that happens, I think, and indicative of the way families are now.
Well, I think it reflects what I said a moment ago about most of the financial and practical assistance flows from parents to children rather than children to parents. I think that also is connected to the uptick I mentioned a moment ago. Since 1990, there's been some growth in multi-generational families. And I think that's mostly because of the extraordinary decline in the income of young adults. We've had a tripling in the percentage of young adults making less than $10,000 a year over the last three decades. And so more and more you're having the young people move in with their parents after they've gone to college or something like that, and that's being reflected in the statistics.
Stephen Ruggles is the director of the Minnesota Population Center, and joining us now from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is Lawrence Basirico. He's the author of The Family Reunion Survival Guide, How to Avoid Problems with Your Family Without Avoiding Your Family. He's the chair of the Sociology Department at Elon University in Elon, North Carolina. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
It's my pleasure.
Why would you say, first of all, simple question, why do we need to stay in touch with our families?
Well, families, I think probably the best way to describe families would be the way that a sociologist named Charles Horton Cooley described them in 1909. He described groups called primary groups. And primary groups are the groups that are really the most important groups in our lives. They're primary in the sense that they give us a fundamental sense of our primary ideals. They orient us to life. They give us a good sense of who we are, our values and our beliefs at the most fundamental level. And certainly families are not the only primary primary groups of which we're members, but it's certainly what I would say the most important primary group for us.
What's the biggest challenge in blending adult families with the family in which we were raised, which is essentially the extended family?
Yes, that's a great question, and it's really the premise of my book and what I talk about. I talk a little bit about issues that develop at family reunions, and the basis for that really is that we're all members, as adults at least, of two families. We're members of our family of childhood. The sociologists would call that family of orientation. And it's really your family of orientation in that that family orients you to the world in its most fundamental levels for you. It orients you to your political beliefs, your religious beliefs. It gives you your sense of relating to one another. And in that family of childhood that you have, or your family of orientation, you and your siblings and your parents have your own way about how to act with each other, your inside jokes, your common languages, and everything. Now, when we grow up and we develop a new family, and sociologists would call that your family of procreation, a simpler term is family of adulthood, there were two sociologists back in the 1960s who wrote an article called Marriage and the Construction of Reality, Peter Berger and Hansfried Kellner. And they contended that when two people get married, they're essentially strangers. Not strangers in that they don't know each other, but they really don't know their spouse's family of orientation that well. So when we get married or we're with a partner, we create a new reality, a new family, so to speak. And that is just as real and powerful as our original one. So every one of us then has these two families. And I would say that in the healthiest of marital relationships or partner relationships, that family that you've created as an adult is going to be different than your family of childhood. If it's not, then it's a very unbalanced relationship because one of you is buying too much into that family of childhood. So when you return...
Go ahead.
So when you return to your family, for example, for a reunion or an extended vacation, you have a little bit of a natural issue built into it. On the one hand, the purpose of reuniting is to bring back to life that original family. That's the purpose of it. Yet, as I was interested to hear Angela's comment a little while ago, she talked about the differences between her and her family. When you go back, you are no longer the same person. And your values, your beliefs might be slightly different. You've got different ways of doing things. And you are remembered for the person that you were, yet you are now an adult with different ways.
Stephen Ruggles, let me just ask you one last question. What do we get from extended families? I mean, if they're not as strong as they used to be, what's lost?
Well, I think that we have to be careful about romanticizing the extended family of the past. I mean, kin ties may have been stronger, but I don't think that any one of us would like to be one of those kinds of families. Hmm. You got to keep in mind that the 19th century family was based on physical force, a force that was sanctioned by the state. Child beating was virtually universal. Corporal punishment for wives was very common. In most states, wives didn't have the right to own property. It was essentially an authoritarian, violent situation. It was held together over multiple generations by the power of the patriarch. Now, you know, I'll talk about claustrophobic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was worse than that. And I think that the current arrangement is a lot more appealing. Obviously, kin do provide lots of services and assistance to one another in both directions across generations. And that's valuable, but it's a trade-off, I suppose.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Professor Ruggles.
Thank you.
Professor Stephen Ruggles is from the University of Minnesota. He's also the director of the Minnesota Population Center. We're talking about the ways in which we connect with our families. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. And when we come back, we'll be talking about family reunions and how they help us to stay connected with extended family. Send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about extended families and family reunions, which some of you may be attending this holiday weekend. Join the discussion. Do you have a great family reunion story? Does your family hold them annually? Does the thought of getting together once a year make you nervous? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Lawrence Basirico. He joins us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's the author of The Family Reunion Survival Guide, How to Avoid Problems with Your Family Without Avoiding Your Family. Let's take a call from David in Miami Beach, Florida. Hi, David.
Hi, Miss Neary.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I felt compelled to call because I am part of an extended family, value it very highly. My household consists of my parents, two grandparents, an elderly aunt. Various times, other family has come to stay with us, and most of our entire family lives within about, I'd say, 20 to 50 miles.
And do you see each other all the time? Are you in and out of each other's houses all the time?
Oh, yes, all the time, all the time.
And do you ever get on each other's nerves?
At times it can be trying, but as the other gentleman had stated, there are trade-offs, and it seems that where we're most apt to put our elderly in institutions for care, this is kind of contrary to what my family believes. And, as it was 2 weeks ago, I drove to Fort Myers, picked up my grandparents, brought them back to our home. They stay with us during the summer months. They're away for about 2 months in the winter. But all in all, it's been a wonderfully enriching experience, and one that is unique in this time, I would say.
All right. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Lawrence Basirico, is this typical, do you think, of the extended family experience?
I think it's fairly typical. Yeah, I think the extended family experience can be a wonderful experience and usually is. Yet at the same time, people have the expectation, because they place so much value on the family and because it's so important to their sense of well-being, that if issues do emerge, I think it's possible that they either bury them or they think that those issues are a reflection of a family that is in trouble. And the point that I try to make is that the closest of families and perhaps even the healthiest of families have differences, and when we have those differences, we need to recognize that there is nothing wrong with those things, and that, first of all, those things can be avoided, but those are natural differences between family members.
All right, let's take another call from Andy in Indianapolis. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I first of all wanted to say, I congratulate the previous caller for taking in his extended family the way he has, because it seems to me that we've replaced most of those functions with institutions either from government or like when you talk about institutionalizing people. We tend to use our worth, the money we make in our jobs and so on, to find a way to put our people away when they're like disabled, elderly, and I'm just afraid that we have a tendency to delegate too much to government, and that programs like Medicare and so on have changed the dynamic of how we care for our elderly to a degree that I think is probably detrimental.
Lawrence Basirico, what's your take on that? I mean, have we given up some of these functions that once belonged to the family, turned them over to the government?
Yeah, I think that's true in many of the cases. Yet I still think that in most families there is still the pull toward feeling the responsibility as we grow up. And one of the values that we've learned from our family of orientation and our that primary group is that we still feel in the role of the responsibility and one of the roles and obligations, let's say, of the child in the family, realizing that there's an obligation to the family. So even when we grow and we grow older and we may have changed, and even though those services may be taken over by others, we still feel that tension and that responsibility, which could add to some internal conflicts with us.
Yeah. Thanks for your call, Andy. I want to just turn the discussion a little bit because I know you've studied the role of family reunions in the
Yes.
life of a family. What's their importance? What do they offer?
Family reunions, I think, are crucial. They go back to the functions of the family. Family reunions can serve as a source of identity, especially for individuals, giving us a psychological anchor. I think very importantly, they give us a sense of our history and our cultural roots and a connection to that. family reunions can provide us with a sense of acceptance. And one of the things that I really focus on is that family reunions can serve as a source of affirmation of our adult identities and roles, which is a little bit of a double-edged sword because, again, I'm using Angela's comments before, as we go back to the reunions, we're seeking that affirmation, yet we are remembered as the person we were when we left the family.
Yeah. Some family reunions, though, are really huge. I mean, and they may involve relatives who have never knew each other at all, had no relationship to each other at all, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to pigeonhole a family reunion. And often, I think, when we think of family reunions, one of the common perceptions of it is this huge 300 people day in the park with people wearing name tags. And I think more and more family reunions have changed over the last 10 years or so in which that family gatherings themselves can serve almost as a source of a reunion. I think what makes it a reunion is that people get together to celebrate that particular family and the roots of that family. So that can take place over a holiday vacation or returning home from a distance. It's not just getting together, but it's getting together to celebrate that family.
How's that different from, say, getting together for Thanksgiving dinner? I mean, how is the reunion specifically, or is it the same thing that you're saying?
I think it really depends on the intention. One of the ways that I use to make that distinction is there's a movie called Soul Food. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the movie. And it's about an African-American family. And I think for most people, I don't know that they would consider that a reunion. They get together about every 2 weeks or so. But when they get together, it's really to celebrate their family rather than just hanging out at somebody's house. And they do that by focusing on the way Mama used to cook her meals, and everybody will buy into that. And so is that a reunion? Of sorts, I think, yes.
Yeah. We're talking about family reunions, and we're talking about extended family and how you relate to your extended family. Give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. And let's take a call from Tony. He's in Newport News, Virginia. Hi, Tony.
How you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, we never had family reunions in our family. I mean, I used to always think it was something that just happened on the Waltons or a little house on the prairie until I actually grew up and moved out. I mean, I love my family, but whenever we get together, it's a massive fight. My father is a Russian, Austrian Jew, and my mother is from Puerto Rico, but she's Portuguese, Arab descent. And I could never, ever see her side of her seven sisters and brother getting together with my dad's family. I just thought it would always be a disaster. And I mean, I see it happen all the time. People get together and seem to enjoy themselves, but even getting together just for a weekend holiday is like, you know, not, it could be happening in Beirut.
Well, we've got the right person here for you. He's written the Family Reunion Survival Guide, Lawrence Basirico. What's your advice here?
I think we need to go back to what I was speaking about before, and we need to recognize that we're all part of two families as adults. There's the family in which we grew up, our family of childhood or our family of orientation, which has a certain way of doing things, and you are a certain person within that family. And there is the family that was created in your adult life. And when two people get together to form a family, there are two of those in there. Each has their own family of childhood, yet they've created a new one. Now, when you get together for a reunion, it's usually to celebrate one of those. And people need to remember and to recognize that we shouldn't just adhere to one set of beliefs, one set of rules, and we need to be tolerant of each other and understand that my views on things, of course, I think they're right because that's what I've developed with my spouse, and that might be different from those of my siblings or my original family of orientation.
But what if fights break out?
Well, my advice there is that planning is essential to having a reunion to prevent those kinds of things. In fact, in my research, I found out that the most well-planned and the most highly structured and most organized reunions tend to be the most successful in terms of satisfaction of family members at those reunions. And the reason that is because that eliminates possibilities at the reunion for decision-making or for those little conflicts can't come up. But if things are worked out before the reunion, it takes a lot of planning to do those kinds of things. But it reminds me of a quote that Paul McCartney made in one of the last songs. And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love that you make. So when those reunions are planned and structured, there's less opportunity. In fact, when I think back about our most successful family reunion, it was at a place in Pennsylvania where we had activities from morning till night, which eliminated the possibility of anyone having to make decisions, which is a very, first of all, very liberating. And so, it's in the charge of someone else.
Okay. Well, I should point out that the 4th of July is the most popular time for family reunions. And so we've asked Edith Wagner to join us now. She's the editor of Reunions Magazine. Welcome to the show, Edith Wagner.
Hi, Lynn.
I know you help people think through reunions. We just heard Lawrence Basirico telling us that the best planned reunions are the best reunions.
Huh?
How do you begin planning for a family reunion?
I think that question isn't just how do you begin, it's when do you begin and where are you going to go when you do that. Everybody does it a little bit differently. But what they have to do first is decide they're going to have a reunion. That may seem like a very simple statement, but there's a lot that goes into that. They have to decide who the family is. Is it, as Dr. Basirico suggested, that it's the parents and or the grandparents and their children and spouses and their children? That's three generations right there. But many reunions, particularly the ones that you were citing before that are 300 or 1,000 or whatever, frequently they are people who are descended from several generations back. The reunion that's in the Guinness Book had 2,500 people, and they were all descended from a couple that settled in Lake County, Illinois, 155 years ago.
Hmm.
So, first of all, you have to decide who the family is. And there are so many details that have to be thought through that giving oneself or giving, you know, the reunion enough time to sort of grow and gel and get ready to happen is all part of doing the successful reunion that Larry was talking about.
Well, is there one thing in particular you advise people on in order to have a successful reunion?
Well, there are a few things, if you don't mind, not just one. Except if I had to be pinned down to one, it would be to suggest that they give themselves enough time, that they start early enough, that they don't try to do it next weekend if they really want to have the cousins come from California.
Mm-hmm.
Because part of you know, deciding who the family is then gets into where are these people coming from, and how are they going to be able to afford to get here if we're going, you know, if they are traveling some distance. Not that many families anymore all live in the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
That's part of, you know, part of the reason why people gravitate to reunions is because they don't all live together and they don't see one another as often as they once did.
We're talking about family reunions and extended families, and Darcy in Portland, Oregon, welcome to Talk of the Nation. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Lynn.
Go ahead.
I'd love it if you were the permanent host for this program.
Well, thank you. I won't tell Neil you said that.
Well, no, you better not. I grew up with 27 first cousins, and we always had family reunions every summer. And now that we are adults, there isn't any formal gathering, and I would love to figure out a way to get at least my cousins together for a reunion. We are all on email, so that's can start it out. But once we get together, how do you form icebreakers to get everyone together and feel comfortable around each other now that we're all adults and haven't seen each other in one gathering for quite some time?
Are you all spread all over the country?
We are most in Oregon. There are a couple of people in California who come to visit Oregon quite often. So I think getting everyone here would be fairly simple. It's, what do I do with them once I have them all together?
All right, I'm going to turn to the experts. Edith Wagner?
I'm glad you asked. First of all, we have Reunions Magazine has a website, and there's a section on the website called Icebreakers.
Oh,
take care of that question. That's a very, very common question, and one that we get particularly now in the summertime. We tend to get it today is Thursday. We tend to get it on Thursday for a weekend reunion. Oh, my God, I forgot to do icebreakers. What should I do? And there are a lot of icebreakers where people don't even have to prepare very much. Trivia or all kinds of family history things, some of the games that if you have done professional training, usually they have icebreakers and all kinds of things that can be adapted to a family that's getting together, and probably things that if you know your family well enough, these are the kinds of things that people will really get involved in. The best kind of course are to try to get all of the generations involved so that the grandparents and the grandchildren are involved in the icebreaker.
Excellent.
Thanks for your call, Darcy.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another call from Janice in Anchorage, Alaska. Hi, Janice.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to share my very recent experience. I just returned on Monday from a first family reunion for our family. There were 31 of us from six states and from Grand Cayman that all gathered together in Grand Cayman for a week.
Grand Cayman sounds like a good place to have a family.
It was wonderful. It was so glorious. And it wasn't just the location. I mean, it was terrific. We were right on the beach, and the ocean was there, and my cousins had boats to take the kids fishing and out to see the waters and everything. But mostly it was just all being together. My cousin that lives there made dinner for us every night, and it was like the very best Christmas dinner from my childhood with everybody all together every single night. And even my little three-year-old cousin, she said that was what she remembered best about the trip and what she, you know, is going to take back with her. And we ranged in age. There was a newborn infant that was only, what, I think 3 weeks old, and my mother's 82. And my kids are, they're 5, 8, and 11, and they're all boys. And it was so wonderful for me to see them interacting and watching, you know, the young people that I grew up as a child that I hadn't really, we hadn't all been together for more than 30 years. And to see, it was kind of like they were role models for them of what brothers can be as adults.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a wonderful story. Thanks so much for sharing with us.
I highly recommend it. I think that even though it takes a lot of effort and it's hard to get everybody together, it is well worth the effort.
Thanks so much for calling, Janice.
All righty, bye.
Edith Wagner, I have to say that it does raise for me the question of how important is location in terms of planning for your family reunion? That sounds like it was a pretty good place to do it.
Yes, and I think location in reunions is exactly the same as location in everything else. That's it. Location can be any place, because going to the Caymans, for example, is obviously a great luxury for most people. Many people go to the place where their ancestors lived. There may not be anyone from the family still there. Many families, because of particular interests, will go places, will use the reunion as part of their summer vacation. Families that camp will go camping, and many camp places are very open to having large groups of families there. Any place that a family can do a vacation, they can also do a reunion. Obviously, size makes a difference. For families, say, for example, a family going to a ranch, for the most part, probably has to be a smaller group than a family going to a large hotel, for example. The place where the reunion is has to, everybody has to be taken into consideration. Can they get there?
Right.
Can they afford to get there?
Edith, I want you to hold that thought, because we're going to continue this discussion briefly after our break. And Lawrence Basirico, stay with us as well. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking with Edith Wagner. She's the editor of Reunions Magazine, and Lawrence Basirico. He's the author of The Family Reunion Survival Guide, How to Avoid Problems with Your Family Without Avoiding Your Family. Let me turn to you for a moment, Lawrence Basirico, because we've been on a pretty high note here regarding family reunions. And yet, as your book, the name of your book indicates, there can be some problems. What's your best piece of advice for avoiding problems, apart from the planning? Once you get there, do you keep certain people apart, or any guidelines there?
I think tolerance of others' differences is a key factor, and if I keep going back to the understanding that we have different families now as adults than we had as children growing up. A few practical things. One thing that we don't want to do is we don't want to spring new things on people at the reunion. We probably can all think of those things in our minds that we would or wouldn't want to talk about. But even great new things in our lives, that probably isn't the time. But I guess the number one thing would be to understand that people are no longer who they were when they were growing up, and they need to be respected for that.
And Edith Wagner, do you hear about problems sometimes at reunions?
To be perfectly honest, and Larry knows this, I hear of very few problems. I think probably, and Reunions Magazine is reader-driven, so I hear from people all the time. In fact, I require, I need that kind of thing in order to make the magazine go. And we hear very, very few situations of problems. I think people, first of all, are not that eager to share it if it happens. And the people that are having great reunions are the ones, apparently, who are contacting us. I understand that certainly, you know, at reunions there can be problems, just like any other family gathering. But I don't hear about them. Lucky me.
Okay. Let's take another call from Jean in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Yes, my family is having a family reunion this summer for my parents' 60th wedding anniversary, so we're looking forward to that. But I wanted to mention something your author seemed to see as a negative in that we are no longer the same people we were as children. But instead, I see that forms a kind of bond that even if you're not emotionally close and our family's scattered out across the country, you get back with people who know you. They don't know anything about you as a manager or someone who's professional or anything like that. They really know you as you were before you built up all those adult kind of walls between people. So I see that as a thing that I look forward to with my family rather than as a negative.
Do you feel, Jean, that you're going to be able to sort of pick up where you left off with some of these people who you haven't seen in a good long time?
Yeah, because I've seen this happen every time we've gotten together. We'll go years without getting together, and then when we get back together, nobody cares. In my family, there's a lot of professionals and doctors and people highly educated, and nobody really cares. It doesn't mean anything. And there's something special about that relationship that I think is a positive as opposed to a negative.
Well, thanks so much for calling, Jean.
Okay.
One other thing I wanted to just close on with the guests, and that is there's an email here, and it's come up a couple of times. Somebody saying, extended family relationships are very important in my cousin, and the best thing we found is email. I keep in touch with aunts, uncles, and cousins, and nieces and nephews weekly. I even found a fourth cousin recently. So I just wanted both of you maybe to comment in closing on the importance of keeping in touch and of course using all the things we now have at our touch, like email, for maintaining family contacts. Lawrence Basirico first.
Absolutely. I think that is key. I think email has become, while some people complain about email as being impersonal, I think it's been a great facilitator of keeping the family together. And as much communication as possible prior to the reunion is great to work out if there are differences, to work out meals, to work out all those details, just to stay in touch and refamiliarize each other with one another. And if there are any earth-shattering events, take care of those things before the reunion. Talk about those. But again, sure, as much communication as possible, I think, is a key.
And Edith Wagner?
Well, the email has just made planning reunions ever so much easier. Many families also have websites, and where they've done newsletters before, and thank God they're continuing to do those, they do, as Larry says, they have so much more contact with people. Even have committees now that are located all over the country, and they do their committee meetings with chat rooms and email and that kind of stuff. It helps reunions a lot.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Prue.
Edith Wagner is the editor of Reunions Magazine. She joined us from her office in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Lawrence Basirico is the author of The Family Reunion Survival Guide, How to Avoid Problems with Your Family Without Avoiding Your Family. He joined us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.